So I'll start by assuming that nobody's ever heard of Oak Street Health. I know that's not true. We actually work with at least one of the plans in the room, but I am our chief medical officer. I'm an emergency physician by training. We run primary care practices, so that's weird, and we can get into that. But I, along with two colleagues, am one of the founders of Oak Street. We've been around about 5 years, and I wanted to start just by talking about our mission, because you can't get to know Oak Street if you don't know why we're doing what we do. So I told you I'm an emergency doc, and I did that because I didn't want to care whether patients could pay me or not. And it turns out that when you get to the emergency department, not only do they still get bills, but then most of the work that emergency departments do is really about getting faster. Is that sort of in, if you lock your mind into what you're trying to do as an emergency doc, you're trying to care for, because of course you're great at taking care of people, nobody would ever argue with that. But you got to get faster because the waiting room's always full. And it turns out that I had this, and it seems weird that it would have happened this way, but this sort of bizarre epiphany that what we didn't need was more emergency departments. We needed better neighborhood-based primary care, especially in communities that don't have access to it. And so we talk about, for the 5 years we've been doing this, that the mission's to rebuild healthcare as it should be, and it should be three things. It should be personal, and by that we mean evidence-based. Everybody should get evidence-based care. It should be equitable, meaning you should have access to that same high standard of evidence-based care. And the third is it should be accountable. And this is a little bit flashy for maybe provocative for a provider group to say, but if you don't take measurably better care of patients, you should go out of business. Now, that's obviously not the healthcare marketplace that we have, but it's the one we're going to have. And we're pretty fired up to be a part of that. And I think as our team has taken a bit of an intellectual leadership position in how we think about the impacts of payment reform, I think you'll see this is a really good thing. And the sicker and the more desperate, the more suffering there is in a community, the more important this work is. So you can't read this. It's designed that way. You can have the slides afterwards, so I'll tell you. But this will be a good chance for me to tell you really who we are and what we do. So we are a network of now 24 de novo primary care practices, focused really on Medicare and Medicaid, in low-income neighborhoods, neighborhoods that don't traditionally have access to primary care. A lot of the patients that we have the privilege of caring for are the ones who use the emergency department. And we're under this, I promise you, totally false assumption that these are patients who don't want to participate in the system that we craft for them. They do. We just haven't met them on their terms yet. And when you create an opportunity in their communities for them to participate in primary care, they want to do that. And I really encourage you to think about these folks that way. All of the, I'll talk about this a little bit. We operate, we call primary care clinics, but with a capital P. So there's a bunch of stuff that goes into, behind, and underneath those primary care practices that lets us do this work. But we are a fully risk-based practice. So, and that doesn't mean like 5% upside in MSSP. It means 100% full upside, downside risk. So if you break our population down, we take care of about 33,000 people. It goes up by a little bit over 1,000 every month. Take that whole list of people, half, a little over half are dual eligibles. Another 25% is Medicare Advantage. A very small slice is Medicaid, straight Medicaid, which is new for us, something we're really excited about. And then we have a chunk of traditional Medicare folks. And if right now you're trying to do the math of how do you do these things, and we lose a bunch of money on those folks and are moving down the ACO path with them. But the objective is to be 100% full risk, because that's really where you're able to not only invest in the right things, but when you do full risk and stuff that works and patients who need it, the returns are there. But really the objective then in a full risk model is invest upfront in populations that need care, keep those people happy, healthy, and out of the hospital. And those are really all the metrics you have to have. Then the economics come out of that. So this is a map of Chicago. We're based in Chicago. We have practices in Chicago, Detroit, Indianapolis, Fort Wayne, Rockford, Northwest Indiana in the Gary area, and we're opening more practices in Philadelphia next year. So, and I will go ahead and say this now. This is not a pitch. I would love to just tell you the good work that you're all doing to help your provider organizations that you partner with move down the path towards value-based care, because that's the way that we're going to unlock personal, equitable, and accountable care. That being said, if you want an Oak Street clinic in your neighborhood, you know how to find me. So this is a map of Chicago. The map on the left, again, I know you can't read it, but I'll just tell you. The downtown area where most of the hotels you've stayed in last time you had a conference in Chicago is in the purple area in the center there. The white is showing folks who are quite low income. So the darker the color, the higher the income. And you can see there's a pattern here. We are very intentionally working in communities that do not, for this reason, is they don't have a lot of resources, do not have access to care. And then on the right side, it's actually not projecting great, but the darker areas are where there are lots of primary care doctors, and the lighter areas are where they are not. Now, there's a lot more sophisticated analysis that goes into actually determining where we put clinics. We actually use a software product that was built to do oil wildcatting, like to find spots to drill for oil, because you can just load a whole bunch of epidemiologic and other data sets on to get down to the block level of where are you likely to have the biggest impact if your objective is to reduce suffering in a community in a value-based model. And these are where these centers come. So I show this to you because I can't fake it. Like, they're actual buildings here if you go by and see them. But the objective then is to build a de novo center and open our doors to primary care for folks on the products we talked about. Essentially, Medicare is the theme. Half of those folks have Medicaid as well, and we're now moving into straight Medicare. Each center has capacity for 3,000 to 4,000 patients that we'll take care of. And if you're now starting to think about, like, where do these patients come from, we're going to get to that. But if you think about it, this is a fully employed, fully risk-based model partnering with Managed Medicare, Managed Medicaid, so essentially MA and duals. And in the states where it exists, the dual integration plans. So I use this as just a stop point for me to give you a sense of the scale we're talking about. We really built a model to achieve those three items of our mission, and you can see them there. We're at about 33,000 patients at the moment. We started seeing patients 4 years ago this month. And the curve kind of has this hockey stick. So we are growing, like I said, a little over 1,000 folks a month. The thing to know, and we'll talk about this, is we partner with 11 different health plans. I'll show you who those folks are. I would love to make that list 1,100 health plans. We try to make available whatever products our patients want. But we do all of the marketing ourselves. I imagine this group's going to want to spend some time on the outreach component of it, so we'll talk about it. The medical group's between 90 and 100 folks, depending on whether you count under contract or people who are working with us, so call it 100 people in the medical group. In our 24 centers, and like I said, we're going to open some more centers next year in Philadelphia. In those six markets we're currently in, and Philly will be the seventh. So I want to talk about two things, because when I think about what we do for our patients, for our teams, and then for our health plan partners to create value, there's really two things. The first there is building communities of patients where they don't exist. So we're going to want to get into this, I imagine, but when we started our practice in Chicago, the Medicare Advantage penetration in Cook County was 8%. It's now closer to the low 20s, and a lot of that growth has obviously been Oak Street. We've done a lot of work, as Dennis introduced, really understanding how people make decisions, not just on which plan they're going to choose, but on evaluating their plan options when it comes to their Medicare benefit. Do you guys know the number one reason that people do not choose Medicare Advantage? We've done this survey like thousands of times. So they actually don't know about it. One of the things that we've been able to do is create a structured process. We're not a plan. We don't sell plans. We work with plans. People can stay in their traditional benefit. But when you invite people to consider their plan options, particularly people in communities who struggle with access and for whom affordability in products, which is what a lot of you guys and your colleagues spend time obsessing about, they choose it. So another question, do you know the number one reason that people leave MA if they leave? Number one reason is they actually did not know they left. So we have whole programs after AEP for people who fall off rosters just to say, like, hey, like, what happened? Like, how can we help you? Did you know that your health insurance changed? So these are the kind of things that, because of some things we're going to talk about, make us just structurally in a better position to help patients navigate that. So building de novo patient panels in neighborhoods where they don't exist, inviting people who are not participating. They're not participating in the healthcare system. They're not participating in managed care. to consider those plan options. And the pathway to take someone over here who's got a Medicare benefit or a Medicaid benefit, but mostly in our case, Medicare, and help them move all the way down the path to where they consider their plan options, join a plan if it's right for them, have a structured geriatric assessment, are screened from an evidence-based standpoint, documented, and then on a care plan that's effective for them, and being demonstrated to have the appropriate care. That whole thing, that whole chart is what we're thinking about. The second then is around the care model. I obviously could spend forever. I won't because it's beautiful outside, but I could spend forever talking about what we do. We'll go into a little bit of detail here. I think if what you think when you leave here is, man, when I heard about their care model, I've heard all of that stuff before, nothing was that interesting, that actually probably suggests we've gotten it right. Because the list of buzzwords on all the white papers that are all in our inboxes right now is all the right stuff, it's just nobody does them well. And so we'll talk about how we've been able to bring those together. So this is the model, the way that we think about inviting people who have never heard of us to join the process and to become an Oak Street patient. We start with community outreach. So of the 1,000 or so folks that work at Oak Street Health, probably 20% of them work on what we call our outreach team. We will do something like 16,000 community marketing events this year. Every center has a community center in the front half of the building that is truly open to the community, staffed by a junior social worker with a small cafe, nothing terribly fancy. But now if you go to, for example, my practice on Tuesdays is in Bronzeville, on 43rd and State in Chicago. The only other place you can hang out if you're an adult in Bronzeville during the day is the McDonald's on Cottage Grove. So this is the other option. It also means that people now participate in the events, consider joining the practice, consider joining the plans that we take, and are way more engaged with the practice because it's not quite as scary to go see the doctor if it's the same place you go to hang out with your friends. So that's the community outreach part. On the educate and engage part, so we, you know, because we've constrained the universe from everyone who needs medical care to adults with Medicare and Medicaid, we've now been able to become the expert in those products, state by state, county by county. In every one of our practices, there's a full-time FTE who's called our patient relations manager, who really helps people navigate their entry into the healthcare system, their plan choice, their plan evaluation, getting the right benefits. And I don't want to sort of cheat what's on later slides, but we've, for example, because we're structured about this, have built what at least we understand to be the world's only CRM designed exactly for managed Medicaid and Medicare Advantage. What that means is when one of our docs flags that somebody's having a hard time paying for a medication, that triggers an alert that says, well, this person has diabetes and they qualify for these special needs plans in the county. Why don't we invite them to come in? Don't even bother the care team. Why don't we invite them to come in and visit with the patient relations manager to consider their plan options? And what we find through doing that is not only does AEP become, look, it's a big deal for us, but it's way less of a deal because over half our patients qualify for a special election period, and we can invite them throughout the year to consider their plan options. And when we do that, we've found that fee-for-service folks joining the practice, and they don't know about their options. They have no idea. Just going through that process of showing them what their options are, connecting them with brokers if needed, if they decide, about 70% of patients that come into the practice will end up joining one of those plans. So that's the second piece. And then the third is around a concierge experience. And this is one of those things where, we are living proof that the reimbursement that Medicare offers is more than enough to cover what we would want for ourselves, for our families. We're doing it in low-income communities because it's what gets us up in the morning. I promise you, as we start to fill this out, you know, we've got practices now in middle-class neighborhoods that are great and thriving, frankly, better than we believe. I'm obviously biased, but better than any concierge practice you're going to find because the structure that is there allows us to take the variation out of the care model and have this concierge experience. So complimentary transportation to and from the centers, no wait times, same-day visits, 24/7 on-call services with access to your doctor where a human being answers the phone. Again, I don't want to sort of blow up my results later, but net promoter scores are not impressive in primary care traditionally, and when we get there, I think it'll demonstrate. This is a really important part of not only the patient engagement model, but from the perspective of our health plan partners, retention. So we have over 97% retention year over year. So it's one of these things that really feeds on itself. So one of the things that we'll do in the outreach model is really partner in a very local way with the folks we work with. So in Chicago, for example, the Chicago Housing Authority, we're one of the few people who are allowed to work with the CHA to connect folks with health resources. There was a really great story of Whole Foods a few years ago put a Southside location in Chicago in a neighborhood you would not expect a South in a not expect a Whole Foods, and it was something that has been really powerful for that community. And we're their next door neighbor, and now are able to do grocery shopping, teaching, and all that kind of stuff because we have this partner next door. I talked about the 16,000 events we'll do, and then obviously having a brand and having a network and having scale. It's folks aren't always, as you can probably empathize, there aren't a lot of folks walking down the street sort of ready to be captured by the value of the actuarial value of the maximum out of pocket in their life, but when you tell someone that you can get a ride to the doctor and you're going to spend twice as long as the national average with that person, and it's in your neighborhood, and there's community events available, that's a far more compelling value proposition. Now, the thing that we like is our value proposition doesn't exist without that of our health plan partners. And so the old game of sort of zero-sum price argumenting between providers and health plan just gets thrown out the window, right? It's Medicare, so we know what the price is. And now we can start talking about where do we want to partner to make these things work. And it's become something that's clearly valuable for patients. Just a little bit of a time on the centers here. So 10,000 square feet, they all look roughly the same. We've kind of got it down to a science. We worked with a great group, an architectural group, who helped us really design a space for older adults. So there's stuff that's, nothing, doesn't seem like it's that big a deal. Grabby bars, wide hallways, nonstick surfaces. Things that are kind of cool are some of the color schemes, non-glare surfaces for folks with macular degeneration. A lot of thought's gone into it, but it's now become a place where, like I said, the community center's got a small computer lab, a little self-serve cafe. There's a calendar of events. These are all things that come out of the box. We now do this so often, it's easy to drop these things into new communities, but it really helps patients feel comfortable, feel like this isn't a system they're getting shuttled through, but rather something that they can enjoy and experience. I wanted to use this just to kind of summarize the way that we're trying to create a value proposition. The staff community center, the transportation, when it comes to the patient experience, the average primary care doc in the United States takes care of about 2,500 patients. The average visit length from the National Ambulatory Healthcare Survey, last year we had data as 2014, was 17.4 minutes. Average Medicare beneficiary is going to have 3 primary care visits in a year with 2 different PCPs because they actually can't get in to see the same person each time. At Oak Street, our teams are a team made up of a physician, a nurse practitioner, a nurse, a medical assistant, a care manager, and a full-time scribe. That full team of 6 people takes care of 500 people. We see our average patient 8.5 times a year, our sickest 5% of people 19 times a year. That does not count all of the house calls and other interactions we'll have. And the average visit length is over 30 minutes. So this is now clearly not a one-size-fits-all model. It does not work for healthy 8-year-olds who need immunizations and school physicals, but that's also not what most of your P&Ls are spent paying for. So it is truly one of those things that the opportunity that we want to have to work with the folks in most suffering is also the one that creates the biggest economic advantage and also the one that's most compelling to patients from a value proposition perspective. So we said, we grow over 1,000 patients a month. 90% of those patients are folks that we go out into the community, engage, and then invite to consider their plan options. If any of you are health plans that would like to just term people in the network and send them over, like, come grab me afterwards. But that's not been what we've seen. It has certainly given our health plan partners confidence in cases where that does become a necessity for economics external to Oak Street. We had a case like this where about 400 people were in a situation like that. 85% of those people had a visit in our clinic in 60 days. So it's one of those things that when you have that ability to reach out very quickly, engage, and in a very structured way onboard folks, and not just onboard into an evidence-based protocol, screen them appropriately, document accurate and specifically, and then have them in a care plan that you know is going to be executed. This is not an NP going to see a patient they've never seen and leaving, never going to see them again. It's a very different way of doing it, but we have high confidence we can do that. And then the last, I sort of cheated here. So Net Promoter Score, you're all familiar with, -100, everybody hates you, +100, everybody loves you. The advisory board published in 2015 that the average primary care practice in the U.S. has an NPS of 3 with no other digits. So Oak Street, over about 55,000 samples and 4 years of data, is at 92. So we're really proud of that. And obviously, right, like that's a gaudy number. I will tell you, I'm willing to admit that I think a big part of that is how much the team cares and the structure and what we have in the value proposition. I also think that we are structurally able. We see the reviews of our health plan partners go up, as do their star scores, as do those other things, because we're there and able to take that frontline position rather than being something that you only call when you have a problem. So the next chunk is on our care model. and this is intentionally small text, hard to read, because I'll talk you through it and you'll get the slides later. But it is essentially the same list of buzzwords you see in every presentation with somebody that looks like me standing up here doing this. What I do think is really powerful is that, first of all, what we do is evidence-based. We don't do things that aren't evidence-based. It's a highly, I would say, structured and academic group, which is a nice thing when it comes to practicing population health because people are trying everything right now. We really break it up into four chunks. The first is a lot of the routines, architecture, and analytics that sits around all this. Our population health team, this is not like a product you buy and then check the box. Our relationships run everything from fully delegated for everything claims included to just participants in the network and have to have the ability to take all of that information in, process that, including all the other data sources. And so I want to talk a little bit about technology in a moment, but that engine, which is house built, and they're actually, now more developers that work at Oak Street than HR professionals, if that tells you kind of what the direction of the organization is. But that really sits on top of a highly structured way that we engage with patients. The other way, the sort of within that, there are three buckets. The first is around multidisciplinary care. We talked about the structure of our care teams. They are highly structured in how they do care, meaning we have an Oak Street guideline for how you manage conditions that's according to best evidence. Those are built by our medical group. But we are now in the place where we can begin to measure variation from that guideline. And then help focus to take variation out of the care model. Essentially, we don't want people going off and getting creative about the right way to manage chronic conditions. We actually want people to focus in on what the best evidence is and help them with tools do that. And by the way, it's also nice when we are beginning to build into the logic now that we have health plan partners with formularies and we can build that logic into the way that we do it and change that stuff pretty quickly. So some of that's in the future, but you can see that structure has become an important part of it. A quick comment on C3, I think just because it demonstrates the complexity and the amount of the way we've defined problems to solve, or if it's a problem for a patient, everybody else in the healthcare system is waiting for them to solve it. We've decided that's our problem and we're going to solve it. So we have a non-clinical space out in the suburbs called C3, which is the Clinical Contact Center, available 24/7, staffed with nurses. And they are equipped so that when somebody calls at 11:15 at night, we don't know whether they are calling to refill a prescription, reschedule their appointment, RSVP for the Silver Sneakers event in the community room the next day, or need to speak to the on-call physician because they can't breathe. And we actually need a bunch of different data sources to come together so that we can take action on those things. And that's what the C3 is for. In terms of preferred providers, we work within managed care networks. Like I said, in some cases, we're fully delegated for that network. In other cases, we're not. We have found there's been a lot of overlap in the MA networks. We've helped our health plan partners tailor those networks. It doesn't necessarily mean smaller. Sometimes it means bigger based upon who's higher quality. But being really there in the front lines working with those folks and being able to have some more intelligence on the way that they manage cases has been valuable. Frankly, and it delivers higher quality outcomes, often at lower cost. An example I'll give you is we have been able to help an ophthalmologist who reached out, our patients adored her. When she found out that when she did cases in an ambulatory center that her patients didn't have a several hundred dollar copay, she just changed her business. She had no idea. The health plan was certainly grateful because he did that for all of her patients, not just her Oak Street patients, but that's the kind of thing that's out there as an opportunity. A couple of quick things just on intensive management. We do really focus special services for our sickest patients. We call them very important patients, or VIPs. These are folks who care teams will go see them in the home. That means like nurse practitioners and physicians are actively driving out to patients' homes to do care if they can't get in. We'll do a lot of the work with our acute and post-acute special post-acute and post-acute partners in terms of managing transitions. We see, and it varies by region, about a 50% reduction in readmissions once we launch that program in a new market. And it's not, you know, it's nothing sexy. It's like just go and do all the stuff that the evidence says and have programs that help our patient, help our teams walk through. When somebody's in the hospital, it's just a simple checklist. Did you visit them in the hospital? Is the family engaged? Do you have the prescriptions? Have you sent it over to our pharmacist to review and fill? Do they have a post-discharge visit? Do they have transportation? Is the house home visit scheduled? Like those are the things that peer-reviewed evidence shows work, and we just have an ability to get them done. There's a few other things here. We do a lot of work with pharmacies. Some of our centers have pharmacies. Some don't because there's lease requirements that they can't be there. But in general, including pharmacy is a big part of that. Social services, every team has a care manager. And in addition to that, we do behavioral health with employed psychiatrists and then LCSWs in every clinic to be sure that we, and I'm sure this will come up later, but to be able to deliver far more timely, more intimate, more sporadic access to behavioral health. If you're waiting 3 months for a psychiatrist, it's lovely that you've got the appointment, but most of the things that need to be done same day without a lot of notice, and so the team's equipped to do that. And then the last is around specialty care. This is specialty care that ties naturally within to primary care, so podiatry, cardiology, we're moving into endocrinology and nephrology. We are not, I'll just tell you ahead of time, we're not a Part B practice. In our neighborhoods, often there's not a lot of depth to the network. And so we often will spend more on certain parts of Part B, more on nephrology, more on non-interventional cardiology, way less on vascular surgery. If you ever find me in an alley somewhere, the vascular surgeons got to me because I'm on record saying that we never want them to touch our patients. But that's because, right, they debride wounds and do bypasses and cut people's feet off. And I'm joking about it when I say it because many of the people who trained me were great vascular surgeons. But that is the goal, and it just changes the way our Part B spend looks. I talked a little bit about the structure of the team. I included this in there so that you can see it. And then we have a group of teams centrally that really build the programs that support that. The one thing I'll add here is our clinicians and medical directors are active participants in programmatic development. That's an important part of the culture because I actually don't feel, as much as I can empathize with provider groups where change management's a big challenge. Look, it's that's always a challenge in every organization, but these are things that our teams want to do. When they applied to medical school and residencies, like this was the stuff they wrote in their personal statements, and we're just equipping them to do that. And so they're actively involved, and people will spend a lot of time and energy trying to help build out, improve programs. We talked a lot about this on the high needs patients, so I included this. This is really like our model for how we think about folks who are sickest of the sick and engaging those folks. Pharmacy, we also talked about. I just put this in here in case you wanted to see the way that we work on pharmacy with health plans and formularies and things like that. And then another, another page here on behavioral health and on the way that we tie mental health services into the primary care practice. And then the final thing is really on VIPs and largely on transitions. It's probably worthwhile just spending a little bit of time on this. We talk about planned care and then frequent touch points. The planned care is that our VIPs, we round on them every week, whether they're in the clinic or not. And there's a whole tool that we've built that's a web-based tool that helps people round on these folks so we know where they are. And we can send specific tasks to team members so that work can get done. There is a team owner. There's an owner for each one of these tasks and each patient so that somebody can be held accountable for making sure that patients get that service. We do a lot of work on some of the engagement statistics that we've not seen done elsewhere around show rate, the number of times, and sort of it's the first derivative of how much they call, essentially. Like if there's a change in trajectory and how they interact with us, that's often a warning sign. And then looking forward, and this is really including our hospice partners and post-acute partners and how we deliver care for folks who may be in more advanced stages of illness. With the frequent touch points, this is just, frankly, visit cadence is a great predictor of virtually everything in primary care. How often somebody's coming adjusted for their acuity helps us predict who's going to get sick. If somebody's a very sick person and we put them on a plan, and our analytics really tell us how often somebody should be seen, based upon their acuity. If they fall off that list, that person's somebody that really starts to freak us out. And we call those no nexts, right? That's somebody without a next visit, and we will chase those people down. That includes calling family, doing whatever it takes to help get somebody back in. We'll do house calls in a lot of those cases because a lot of times that means somebody's not able to come because they aren't able to come, and so we need to go see them. We'll do in-home or in-clinic post-discharge visits depending on patient's availability to do that. Medication reconciliation for every visit for our VIPs. I would encourage, you probably all know this, but even in our case, patients spend less than 1% of their lives with us in clinic. The other 99%, virtually the only lever we have on their physiology is the medications they take. So if they don't have the right ones and they don't know how to take them, then it doesn't matter how fancy your residency program, it doesn't matter any of that stuff. It's not going to work. And we've had patients, very well-intentioned patients, who told me to my face, like, yeah, what I do is I put it in a bowl, and every morning I get up and I have a handful. They eat them like Skittles. Like, it doesn't work that way. And it's not, I say that not to be funny. I say that, like, that's how deep, in some cases, the misunderstanding of what our instructions are. And I think a traditional system says that's their problem. No, in fact, like, that is our problem, yours and ours included, because not only economically are we paying the bill, but we're the ones that people are looking for to help advise them and help connect them with the services that are going to keep them healthy. And then the last is around having care managers actively involved. You know, I heard pretty recently Andy Slava give a talk, and he gave a really brilliant answer. Somebody asked him if he could change one thing about HHS, having spent several years at CMS. What would he do? And he said, you know, we call it Department of Health and Human Services. It's a $2 trillion budget. We spend $100 billion on human services and the rest on health. And so this is really one of those things. There is no amount of care managers that we can invest in that wouldn't stop showing a return. It's actually just the ability to have them engaged in the care model. And so where you're supporting provider groups with care managers, or where you can encourage provider groups to support themselves and their patients with more care managers, it will pay off. This is sort of a larger graphic of our care model structure. We've talked through all of that. I think most important is just the results, right? We've cut hospital admissions relative to benchmarks in our neighborhoods by about 44%, a similar number for ED visits. Folks, that's the savings. It all comes in Part A. That goes to fund all of the stuff on this page, and then some. And it's coincides with a 5-star HEDIS score, which is in this population, I will tell you, anybody you know who has any policy influence, star scores are tied to revenue, and they are not risk-adjusted, which is a huge penalty if you're poor and live in a neighborhood where you don't have access to care. Huge penalty. And not to be weird about that, but if you look at where star scores correlate, they correlate nearly perfectly with the income of the county. So I think it's really important, like, just know that for us to achieve a 5-star practice in these communities is crazy. And I'd love to see us break that connection, especially if we're going to pay more for high star scores. Feels weird to pay in communities where they already have the resources. That's my soapbox. But for those of you who have patients living in these communities, not only would it be our privilege to help you take care of them, but this, I think, should demonstrate that it's not me, it's the team, but the team has a structure in place that helps us deliver very consistent evidence-based care. I include an unintelligible technology slide because I think it's mandatory these days. But I will tell you, you know, if this is a little bit different for this audience, but when I talk with groups in the provider space, I think we're all waiting for, like, the perfect piece of technology that somebody in California in a hoodie is going to sell me, and it's not coming. It doesn't work that way. It is too complex an ecosystem for somebody who actually hasn't spent any time taking care of patients to digest this and boil this into one tool. And it also, I will tell you, a big part of the value proposition that we create for our patients, but also for our plan partners, is we want that complexity. If we can simplify that so that patients can have a half-hour conversation during AEP with a PRM, not know anything about managed care, evaluate their plan options, walk out with the right plan, and at the same time have a care model coincident with that payer status, like, that's perfect. We're happy to take that on. That in and of itself is a model. But it means that all these things on here, from Greenway, which is our EMR, to EasyCap and EasyCare, which are both, like, some of you probably use this, like, back office TPA stuff for our fully delegated plans, InContact is the service that we use to manage our phone service. We've done some really interesting work with Bluebutton that I just think is worth a point of data sharing. So you're probably all familiar with Bluebutton, but if there's a couple folks who aren't, I'll tell you. Bluebutton came out as a part of the ACA. It is a web-based thing. You can go to, just type it in and go as a beneficiary and type in your Medicare number and get your previous 3 years' claims history from Medicare. It's a part of the initiative to make that data more available and make it more transparent to the beneficiary. It comes to you in the convenient form of an unintelligible XML file. So I would imagine that very few beneficiaries can do anything with it. But because we know these folks, we have a we have a community center with a computer lab. We download this, and it plugs right into the EDW so that new patients who don't know anything about Oak Street, who are transitioning from traditional Medicare into a managed care product, we, when a doctor walks into that first visit, have their 3 years of claims history already loaded into our EMR. And we know, who did they see, where did they see them, what did they prescribe, what conditions do they have, do I need to rescreen for those conditions? This is a really powerful tool that, again, nobody's building that into EMRs because it's not what they're thinking about. But that's the example that we use to try to demonstrate the complexity that we tried to take on. Similarly, there's a little graphic up there for something called Sprout, which is the CRM we built to help patients navigate and for us to know how to serve them in AEP, SEP, and it integrates all of the clinical data and all of the non-clinical data so that when somebody wants to evaluate their plan options, they have that stuff available. It also plugs in with claims and other things, and I always love this because we're big on arboreal metaphors at Oak Street. This whole thing is called Canopy, which we're excited about. So I'm about to wrap up here and we'll take questions. We really think about how we can create value, and there's sort of three stakeholders here. The first is you guys, is health plans. We can't do this model without our plan partners. Being a full risk practice in and of itself is helpful for plans. We work with major national plans who do risk in many geographies. We've also worked with smaller regional plans who we are their first full risk plan, and we drew up that contract with them from a blank Word document. That in and of itself has been shown to be valuable. We also can focus in on the patients who are not only having the worst experience with their Medicare benefit, but they're getting the worst results. And frankly, we like being, you know, maybe it's swagger. We like taking on the hardest problems. So for folks who are may have members who are very sick and are not getting care, everybody else is running away and we're running towards it. The other thing is we can certainly be that differentiated primary care offering. And part of that's help health plan partners grow. I know this from the slide I'm about to show you. One of the national health plans, we know this because they told us this, we counted for over 50% of their aggregate growth in 2016 in terms of new membership. We don't sell health plans. Other health plans grew as well. But the combination in some cases of people having products that fit really well with our communities and our ability to help connect patients with that opportunity to consider plan options is valuable. To PCPs and providers, this is one of those things, like I said, this is what they want to do. We do a survey 4 times a year. We shut the practice down, and this is my academic bias. We shut the practice down. We have grand rounds. We have academic lecturers come. We spend time on professional development, and we do an anonymous survey at that every quarter. 98% of our groups, of our medical group, so that's the docs in the group, say they are somewhat or very engaged in the practice. A similar number say this is the place where they can practice their best medicine. And a similar number say they have a work-life balance, which I actually would say is too high because they have too many patients that need their help. So it's probably shame on us for not having more for them to do. But I say this because that in alone is satisfying. And I think when you see folks moving to this model because they want to be a part of it, I think it's a great sign for evidence-based medicine, for health equity, and for payment reform. And the last is Medicare patients. And it's the things we talked about, happy, healthy, and out of the hospital, and being able to deliver that at some level of scale has been important. So this is the health plan landscape. We'd love to add some dots to this, but we started in Illinois. So there's a bunch there. We're kind of moving through, adding some others in other geographies. And we'll be in Philadelphia next year and are actively, really largely with sort of two groups, with Larger provider groups who may have hospitals and specialty groups, and then health plans. Those are the two partners we're really looking for expansion plans with additionally on top of this in 2018 and beyond. I always like to end with results and just reiterate. So we focus a lot on happy, healthy, and out of the hospital and going in reverse order. You know, this is what makes things work at Oak Street is the 44% reduction in hospitalizations. This is our star score by HEDIS metric. If you're like me, then you're obsessing over the 3-star score there. So I'll tell you, this is a great, gives me a great example to admit like where we failed last year, but also say we are well on our way to 5 stars this year because of our value-based arrangements. It makes perfect sense for us to go and buy a machine that allows us to do dilated retinal eye exams in every clinic. And when you're in communities that don't have ophthalmology services, this is a great way to do that. So I'm excited. I think it's a great story of how the cycle feeds on itself, but also that we're obsessed and we're going to fix this. And then the last is around NPS. And you guys all know this. I always love pointing out that data point from the advisory board around 3%. You know, we have... I think because of the open nature of our collaborations with health plans have helped them improve this in our geographies as well. And it's an important part of patient engagement. Happy patients are engaged patients, and engaged patients are healthy patients, and that's what we're trying to do. So that's my last slide. I'm going to just go back and put this up here so there aren't a whole lot of distractions, and then I'll hang around for questions as long as you're interested. But mostly I just wanted to say thank you for having us. I get to be here and take credit, but there's a team of people who care a lot about our patients, and the opportunity to share our work with you is a privilege. So thanks for having us.
Marianne, I saw your name up there, so...
And that is a lot of my Southern accent. I'm sorry about that.
New though, I'm with Hap, but and that's a new relationship for us. But I just want to give you a very ringing endorsement for your organization. I visited one of their clinics as we were trying to decide to put this relationship together. But I think this is a huge, huge example we can get our heads around of disruptive innovation. Because this is taking the traditional physician's office experience and turning it on its head. And I think you really can only do it when you're starting from scratch. You came in and started it. You're not trying to turn this something old and tired and stayed into this, right? And I think that, I mean, so HAP is owned by Henry Ford Health System, who I think is a little unnerved by this. Because this is something, these are the neighborhoods that they practice in too, but... they can't do this because they have baggage. They have a lot of baggage, and you guys are very fleet of foot. And I think that my biggest pain is that you came in with an arrangement with Humana, which just breaks my heart. And so
we should talk about that too.
Well, and I get it. I mean, you know, Humana built your building and that kind of thing. But we will have a HAP sign on that building.
Actually, we should talk about that here because I think there's also this part, the bad part of starting, the good part from starting to scratch is it's fun. You get to do exactly what you think is the right thing for patients. The bad thing is people tell you you're crazy. You have to take out personal loans and almost get divorced to buy medical supplies your wife's never met. But there's also, sometimes you just can't get meetings. So in some cases, we have had, actually in this case, we have for one product line an exclusive relationship. It's actually been a great relationship. That there's no commentary there, but like I'm telling you in front of all this group, like I really want to go to Flint for a whole bunch of reasons. Please don't take from that we've got special tricky relationships everywhere. Where they help us go to a new community, they can. But I will tell you, our team is really fired up about the MMP.
Well, really and what I would say to that is to everybody in the room, if you can get an Oak Street to come into your area, and we describe this to the Oak Street folks in Detroit, we probably at a provider-owned plan, a community-based plan, particularly a plan that has a lot of inner-city representation, probably would be a very much stronger feeder for you of patients to come in than a Humana would because you're local. So I think that the local plans... that the Alliance represents is probably as much of an opportunity for Oak Street as Oak Street is for us because we can get you access into areas that the big plans probably can't.
Nice to meet you, by the way.
I have about 16 different questions for you, but sure, I'll try to limit it down. Yeah. And actually, the first question maybe is, Marianne, you can kind of reflect on this too, is being as a part of a provider-owned plan, What was the reaction from the, how did that conversation go with the parent company? And then the second question is on care management. I just want to ask you that.
Yeah.
You guys can both answer this question. You know, I'm just curious.
So I would say it was interesting because it was the Oak Street model that caused one of the physicians who was a hospitalist in the medical group, who's still in the medical group, because everybody's still in the medical group, to jump over to HAP and work on the MMP. It's the demonstration project for the dual eligibles in two counties in Southeast Michigan. And he jumped over to the plan side and said, this is exciting. I want to work on this kind of stuff. And the medical group's not moving fast enough. And so he is incredibly engaged with the Oak Street model and wants to like move this forward. So I think there's half of the medical group that thinks this is a great idea and they want to be on board with it. And then there's the other half that are kind of dragging their heels. Henry Ford is trying something similar to this, a little bit different, of their own. They call them these comprehensive care clinics. And it's not going as well. But if you think about it, you said you take 5,000 patients in a center?
3,500
patients. Yeah. I mean, there are plenty of people to go around. That you could have.
Yeah.
The health group could make these types of clinics. They could make these types of clinics. We'd still be scratching the surface of what.
Well, and I agree that your comment that the baggage that's there does hold back those systems from being able to deliver in those communities. Even if they're based in those communities, they still struggle. The question I had on care management, and this is you're focused in Medicare, Medicaid, dual eligible space. Does your feeling about the value of care management hold true also in the commercial space, in your opinion, or not? Because it's a little harder to.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's an area that you could touch on. Because I understand. I agree with you in the Medicare.
I think that is such an awesome question. I'm not saying that to flatter you, because this is something that with our own team we talk about. So first of all, we focus on Medicare and Medicaid. I don't have any problem with young, healthy, rich people. I would love to be a young, healthy, rich person someday. It's actually just that when you look at where the problem is, that's not where it is. So when you set that, like, that's why we focused in. And it turns out that we were able to create some payment innovation in that space pretty quickly that got us to full risk. The framework that we use for this is the same framework. If you threw down the New England Journal of Medicine for me and told me to look at an article and decide whether I was going to change my practice based upon this, I would look at four things. I would look at the population, I would look at the intervention, I would look at who they're comparing that group to, and I would look at the outcome they're measuring. So for care management, for example, like for us, we're going to always lock into things that are like big headline, pretty easy to measure outcomes like hospital admissions, readmissions, in some cases, mortality. But those are the big things that are going to determine all the stuff patients care about. And then for us on the economic side, the comparison group is just the group we're not giving care management to. The intervention then is like, we're just going to call it care management. And that we can get more specific than that. The most important piece of it is actually population, and it's what you're asking. And the example I always use is like, I promise you that I can lower hospital admission rates by giving out fish tacos. I promise. And you're like, that seems so stupid. But it's like, no, if I give it just to the people who eat ice cream three meals a day, I definitely can keep those people out of the hospital. And so it is. For a 64-year-old with a bunch of chronic conditions that looks exactly like a 65-year-old, that's part of the reason we've reached into Medicaid. We'd actually be super interested in doing like chronic care models for commercial populations for that reason, because clinically defined, their physiology looks exactly like we defined our model for. As soon as you go back in acuity and age, and there's sort of a 2x2, no matter how, for example, no matter how healthy, like if you know, a 65-year-old triathlete, retired Goldman Sachs partner is like not going to get a lot of value out of Oak Street. They're going to have a great experience, but like what we're geared around is not that. Similarly, when we have, we've had pregnant moms, for example, who are duals, who join us because they, and if you get an internal medicine trained geriatrician on the phone in the middle of the night, they're not going to know what to do with that person. So the actual answer to your question is no, the healthier you go, obviously, the less the return is in those cases. That's actually why we focused on that. But defining that population is really, really important in determining. You got to sort of lock one thing down, lock down the intervention. If you're saying care management, great, you got to go find the population that's for, or lock down the population. For us, we said it's older adults with chronic disease, and this is the intervention that we came up with. But please, like, 64-year-olds with chronic disease are going to look like 65-year-olds, and we would love to work with those folks. We have not done a commercial contract yet. I'm actually kind of waiting for that to happen. And you got to solve questions around attribution. You got to solve questions around how people get into the product. But I will tell you, we're doing full risk PPO and love it insofar as we can define it ahead of time, and it does work. So
I'm a former health system president, and when I'm listening to your model, you get at the heart of the matter because many physicians don't like having their days full of these chronic patients.
Yeah.
They want I'm talking group practice. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, it's actually a follow-up question that we'll over here to, is that I see great opportunity to partner with integrated healthcare delivery systems that really getting at, you know, taking care of these chronic patients and for, you know, commercial patients, the healthier ones for those docs who want to focus on that. Talk to me a little bit about what experience that you have doing that, because then maybe the conversation with the art, like for mm-hmm. example, my organization, the owners, would be easier to say, I'm not bringing in a competitor.
Yeah.
I'm bringing in a complementary resource to help us manage.
So I think first, it's just good to give fact, which is the call I was on right before this. One of our health plan partners has a not an integrated system, but a large provider group really anchored by a hospital and a bunch of specialty assets. They are introducing us to say, you don't do this. This is not competitive. It's complementary. And that conversation, once actually brokered by a health plan that sort of knows their economics very well because they pay them, has gone really, really quickly. You know, a lot of our conversations now are with academic medical centers, and I'll admit that for us, so where I went to medical school, where I trained, one still does not, and the other just pretty recently opened a family medicine department. They essentially are giant, in many cases, like actually ivy-covered buildings that are in neighborhoods that have people who are suffering that they have very deliberately not created access to and done specialty and acute assets, and in some cases post-acute. And we are insofar as you believe that they're going to have to change their business towards value-based reimbursement methods and knock out a couple of floors of the hospital and make those post-acute and primary care and behavioral health, we are the perfect complement. And it's actually just what you were saying, Corinne, is like, how can we, in a non-confrontational way, set that up? And the way that we've phrased it is really two ways. Number one is we'll share with you the model of how the economics work. Like, if we were to do something together, we can even co-own it if we wanted to. Here's how the economics would split out, and that's just a math problem. The second piece of that, I'm sorry, I'm kind of losing my train of thought here, is that they don't have any other path to get there. There's no way that they're going to be able to get there, and so even if we cut hospital admissions by 40%, the ability that we can go out in the community, so that one patient is 40% less likely to go to the hospital, but if we bring that person's three friends who's not participating in the system in to a model that has positive economics, that is actually accretive. That's just you got to take that next step of logic, and you kind of have to trust that, like, this Oak Street group's going to help me, frankly, increase market share, number one, and invite people to participate in the system. We've seen it. It's just nobody likes to do that before they've experienced it. Does that answer your question?
It does, but I want to talk to you about Milwaukee.
Okay.
Hi, my question is, you focused a lot on the care management model and savings from reduction of ED and inpatient. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to decipher and understand how much of the financial secret sauce here is actually getting the appropriate revenue from the government with risk adjustment. It feels like your model would be an efficient way to do that.
So I'm actually glad that comes up because it's easier than me doing it forward. So number one, just stepping back, risk adjustment is a thing that, you know, the NHS in the UK does this. Global bureaucracies, like governments, are trying to find out how to attach resource to need. The HCC model is our version of that. We are personally working in communities that, because, like, for example, in Chicago, when we started 8%, that means 92% of the patients that came to us were not in Medicare Advantage before, and thus were certainly not documented appropriately. Our community risk score is like in the 0.7, 0.8 range. So if these are people that are the average male dual eligible in Chicago's hospital admission rate per 1,000 per year is 770, just to make very, very clear, like the economics on that person are so far negative at those two rates. That you have to do both. I will tell you, we consider ourselves far more on the cost side than we do on the revenue side. The advantage we have on the revenue side is just the structure that we do. And I would offer three things. Number one, risk adjustment is really important from a health equity standpoint. If we didn't have risk adjustment, we couldn't serve these communities. Number two, we do third-party audits and present these at the board level. With things like 97% accuracy. Essentially, CMS signs off on anything over 70. Our auditors had never seen that. It's highly structured. It's just a process. The other thing, which I think is the most important one, is we would love for the people at CMS who are actually doing a really great job on building these programs. They're super complex because this isn't simple. If they go and change the rules so that it becomes less about sending a stranger to write a bunch of stuff on a piece of paper about a stranger and then leave that stranger and never see them again, we would welcome it. Because the goal is meet someone, do evidence-based screening, document those conditions accurately and specifically, and then do that, get them into a care plan that's appropriate, delivering evidence-based care, and then revisit that at a cadence. Like, that's an awesome thing for patient care that's highly clinically relevant. But the point you're getting is like, you have to be accurate to be able to serve these communities. The answer to that is yes, but we love letting people look under the hood of this part, because if you believe that what we're doing is some financial engineering scheme that you know we just haven't shared yet and that somebody's going to figure out and we're going to go away, I want to eliminate that doubt anytime. And I'm not saying that's what anybody's saying, but it is really the hard work of practicing evidence-based medicine and documenting people after their evidence-based screening that gets you there. I'm sure we could go a lot deeper on that, but we certainly take pride on the accurate screening and documentation. I think more importantly is tracking people into evidence-based care plans and being able to demonstrate very clearly for every HCC on the list, they're in a program, and in the cases where it matters, in a disease management program that we're fully delegated to operate.
Other questions, Joe?
How rural can you go? Or is this somewhat of a Kaiser Permanente-esque model where you start trying to do it in Kentucky and you're going to get slapped down?
Joe, so it's a great question. There's like Oak Street answer, and then there's what I think it means in the very long term. So Oak Street answer is we operate in Rockford and Fort Wayne, which are not giant places and have actually seen success. Those models look like they do anywhere else, which means we haven't broken it yet. And I think you can get smaller. I'm also, it's the funny thing about that is what we found is really the only difference is the radius from where patients live. And that same piece of mapping software I was telling you about, when we plot out where our patients come from, the vans have to drive a little further, but the traffic's a little bit better. So the drive time's about the same. So you can do it. Now, the second thing that I hinted to is just the subjective experience of being in markets, and I think the more rural, the more you get there, is they're traditionally just a little bit less integrated, less the provider network, less integrated, and have, how would I say it, maybe a little bit more reticence to this kind of model. So I think I don't often use the word disruptive because it seems a little like business school-y, but like it is a little bit more disruptive. But the interesting thing, and our CEO is one of our co-founders, one of my very good friends, has this phrase, which is you don't have to, if a lion's chasing you and trying to eat you, you don't have to be the fastest. You just have to be the second slowest. And so in a lot of those markets where it's just a fee-for-service frenzy, just introducing this one thing into that market, like, it changes things a lot. Frankly, I'll just give you an example. In one of those markets, we saw in 1 year our average SNF length of stay go from over 50 to 14. Right? And it's and like, they don't. We're just able to go and like practice evidence-based medicine.
Do you want my platinum members? You can have.
Other questions or comments? Brendan?
A quick and easy one. How do you compensate your physicians?
Oh, yeah, that's easy, right? So there are wide theories on this. There are people who will take almost like spiritual stances that you have to just pay salary and that should be enough. I will tell you, people change their behavior based upon their incentives. Our philosophy here is, look, if we hire all the best people from somewhere else, they come here, that place gets worse and we get better. We actually didn't make the healthcare system better. So first of all, the goal is let people select to be at Oak Street because they share our values around evidence-based medicine, health equity, and accountability. And if they select us, that should be a big part of it. So we don't want to pay at the 100th percentile. We don't want to pay at the 1th percentile, the first. We want to pay a little bit above the median. We want to pay salary so that people can show up and not worry about it. And then we want to pay pretty gaudy variable bonuses based entirely on the things that patients care about. And the bonus program's like not super complicated. It's like hospital admissions, risk adjusted. It's stars score. All of these things are done at the clinic level, by the way, so that teams share in this stuff. And the cool thing is seeing that teams now start out, and they come in as community docs. Like, they've never seen this compensation model before. I should also add, we don't calculate RVUs. We don't know how to calculate them. They're, like, totally irrelevant to our patients, so that's not in there. It's all stuff we talked about. But it's cool now to see as the medical group grows and matures, they're actually interested in more complexity because they see how their behaviors change patient outcomes, and they kind of want to chase down that complexity. So the program gets a little bit more complex probably every year. But these programs, they can either be fair or simple, and you just got to let the medical group choose. So we really guys, here's the amount of bonuses that we can pay out. Like, we have a team that kind of tells us what they want their bonuses to be on, and then they go run up the program for the year. But we do believe in variable comp, and it's shown to be a pretty powerful motivator.
John? Well, first of all, really exciting work. Good work.
Thank you.
I think that's exciting to hear. But I was curious about recruiting. Mm-hmm. So you've just answered a little piece of that. But you're certainly, you must have a recruiting challenge. It sounds like you're out there recruiting people that actually want to practice medicine on a really difficult...
What do you want me to say to them?
Well, on a really difficult population.
Yeah.
And most clinics, they're across the country, are challenged to get primary care to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And most of the folks I interview are not overly motivated to see really complex Medicare patients all day long. So maybe you can talk just a little bit
sure.
about your challenges or the recruiting part of your business.
So, you know, it's funny. The recruiting challenges don't come because your recruiters aren't good or you don't have the right marketing message. And in some cases, paying works. But, like, if people wanted to make the most money practicing medicine, they would all move to some of these places in the middle of the western states where it's beautiful, but it's not dense populations and they're paying people crazy numbers. I think the reason the recruiting challenges come, and this is not a criticism of any individual organization, I think this is a systemic problem, that we haven't made the job necessarily great. And I'm not one, I gotta watch how I say this, because I help lead a team of docs that I care a lot about, who care a lot about patients. But, you know, I think when we hear about physician burnout, there's part of that I want to hear. But in our case, like, if you've got one of our docs in the room and one of our patients in the room and you have to choose which one's suffering, like, I'm not super compelled that our clinicians are the ones who are suffering. The problem is that traditional systems have teed up clinicians to do hard things with no resources. I think this is actually the challenge in a lot of cases of, if you give people 10-minute visit slots, you know, I can crush through a whole bunch of, you know, paronychias and wrist sprains in 10-minute visits, no problem. And I can get my note done and be home early. But as soon as you give me someone with multiple chronic conditions who lacks for health literacy, has social challenges and behavioral health concerns, now my, you know, this is what they call them. They call them schedule busters. And we try to be pretty tight around our practices of not using those terms because they're pretty derogatory. But I think that's where we've gotten, is nobody wants to sign up for that because it's an impossible task. It's 100% totally impossible task. The challenge now is that when you've got a team of five people and $350,000 worth of FTEs supporting you as a clinician, and all of this technology and 30 minutes to spend with patients and a panel of 500 people, and you're paid above the median, and the practice is closed 4 days a year for grand rounds, and you've got a nurse taking call for you, and I'm like, dude, you don't have any more excuses. Like, you show up and take great care of patients, and if you're, I mean, and this is the thing that, like, you start to get into some pretty provocative territory, but look, the peer-reviewed literature out there, this is not me, this is not Oak Street speaking, the peer-reviewed literature done in the UK, in the NHS, and here in the States shows that NPs equivalently matched for acuity take equivalent care of patients with a statistical trend towards lower cost. That people who train in more community-based settings versus like places where I trained take better care of people at a trend towards lower cost. So if we can go back to rewarding primary care instead of rewarding the failures of primary care, it just changes who. So people show up and work hard and they obsess about their patients. And it's the same person who 6 months ago was in another practice. And I don't think it's because of necessarily like our amazing leadership team. I think it's structural. So I just don't blame the people. I blame the situation. Getting to recruiting, we see a lot of people applying. More and more people are applying than before. The hardest part for us is just getting the word out. And then very honestly, some people look at our locations and they're afraid and don't want to go there. Not all of them. Some of these are in nice areas with a Chipotle right across the street and your life's easy. But a lot of them aren't. And that's the place, John, where we need people who I really think are heroes to raise their hand. And it doesn't have to be the flashiest resume. It doesn't, it has to be somebody who cares about patients. We'll equip them, they'll succeed. I think the interesting thing is the variation in performance is not that wide. But the recruiting challenge for us is just telling that story. Because once they hear the story, it starts to feed on itself. Where we do have challenges, it's just by location. I don't know if that answers your question or not. But
been very impressive.